Black Cats Run Podcast. I'm Tristan Black Ingersoll, and this is Black Cats Run. Today's episode on the rails is meant to join with follow up on the previous episode, The Fulcrum Effect. And the focus of this episode is to try to bridge the gap across what is the most challenging space in training for running, cycling, skiing, swimming, whatever your endurance sports focus is. How do we take concept and then turn it into application? Let's get into today's episode. There's a big difference between what we can picture ourselves doing in our mind's eye and what is actually feasible. I sometimes do this little thought experiment slash exercise with students in the classroom when I'm trying to get them to see the difference between perceiving and understanding something on observation versus our ability to create it. I ask students, I say, raise your hand if you have a pet at home, right? Or if you have a sibling or parent, right? Some person, thing that you're very familiar with, picture that in your mind's eye, right? You can conceptualize what that looks like in a photorealistic sense. Then I say, okay, here's a half a sheet of paper. You have 30 seconds. Take out a pencil. I want you to draw that. What's in your mind's eye? Then 30 seconds are up. I say, okay, let's take a look at what we came up with. Does this match what we had in our head? Is this what we created on paper in practice? Is that equivalent to what we visualized? And of course, the answer is no. And so then say, okay, well, what if you worked on this for 24 hours? Would it become photorealistic? And, you know, the answer is still almost always going to be no, because it doesn't matter how much time you spend trying to work on something. If you don't have the basic skills to support that, to implement it, then it's not going to ever represent what you have conceptualized. And in that sense, we have the same problem with training, where we can encounter new material, new ideas. We can get excited about what that maybe represents, what the possibilities are going to be for us in our own training practices as athletes. But then in point of fact, we cannot get what we create in practice to represent what we are conceptualizing in our head, because practice and implementation requires a different set of skills beyond the ability to engage a concept and maybe describe that back to somebody else. And that is the challenge of application. And I think that what we tend to do is we tend to default to previous habits. And I see this all the time with people, where you will have a lengthy discussion, conversation, break something down. This needs to look like this. This needs to look like this. Okay, let's try again. You end up with basically the exact same thing, because the transformation doesn't happen in the conceptual stage. The application is a skill in and of itself, and it's a transposition of what is in your mind's eye into the reality of what you're doing and what you're performing. So what we want to try to talk about is how do we transition and apply this stuff? And for my money, I do think the conceptual aspect of it is in some ways what's the most interesting to talk about and discuss. And it's very challenging to identify and guide application unless you're working with somebody and, you know, in person and consistently. You know, when I've worked with athletes remotely in the past, the process has always broken down and usually very, very quickly. A lot of times after the first conversation, there is no follow-up. And I don't think that that's a shortcoming of any individual. I think that is just reflective of the difficulty between conceptualization and application. Okay, I hear somebody, they have some ideas. I want the value of these ideas. And then we can visualize ourselves getting down the road and then having had the benefit of having applied this. But then when it comes time to actually hit the light switch to start doing it, everything falls apart because people just don't have the skills. We don't know how to do that. It's inherently challenging, but I think it's something that's worth discussing because I do think it is attainable for us to figure that out. But it's something that we have to say, okay, this is its own domain, its own extension. It's not enough to simply establish the idea. We need to go further than that and say, how do we move idea into practice? And there's this dichotomy that people like to think about that, you know, theory and practice are two different things, and they aren't different things, but they are distinct things, right? The skill of practice and the skill of theory are not the same skill, but when you link them together, right, the whole is almost as if it's greater than the sum of its parts. So we established in the last episode that the goal in training is keeping within the zone of proximal development as much as possible. And across the timeline of Black Cat's Run, we've explored different ways of thinking about what is the right way to load and apply training intensity. And we've tried to make the argument that essentially people train way more intensively and create way more fatigue and demand on their body in an effort to improve than is A, necessary, and B, is actually beneficial. And we've moved over time as we've explored theory and considered different concepts and different approaches to this towards this argument that improvement happens best in keeping with what we know about effective practice in general, which is that perfect practice, right, prevents piss poor performance, right? Or what that really means is if you're not practicing proficiently, then you're not practicing at all, right? So if you're tying up and fatiguing out and losing coordination, you're not practicing proficiently anymore. You can still have your heart rate elevated. You can still do something that is running or cycling or swimming or skiing, but I would argue you're not really doing what you're trying to do anymore. You're trying to be proficient. And once that proficiency is lost, is that really helpful? Okay, right? So how then do we make a distinction about this? Well, one of the things we talked about in the previous episode was this really means we have to toss out this idea that hard days are what equals improvement. And then these hard days are separated by these recovery days as easy days / easy days as recovery days. And these labels are very misleading because people will say, oh, I took a recovery today or an easy day. And that implies in technical terms, oh, they were going easy and that facilitated recovery. That's what that's supposed to mean, right? But in practice, that's not what's happening. Usually people's easy days or recovery days are hard. Sometimes they're harder than the days that are supposed to be hard because they brought themselves to such a level of exhaustion and failure on the hard day in the first place, right? Which then comes to the fact that the hard days are too hard and that there's actually no place for hard days, that hard days are the antithesis of effective training. And we need to eliminate those or think about those differently, right? Whereas a hard day is really something that is moving towards the boundary of what your capacity currently is. But that requires proficiency. So it's about feeling good, right? It's about experiencing ease in that context, right? And if you put a name tag on a rock, it doesn't make it your friend. So in that sense, just labeling things on Strava or Training Peaks or in a plan that you bought online or in a notebook, you know, if you like to be analog, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change the reality of it. The rock is still a rock. It's an inanimate object. You can't relate to it. Okay, you can delude yourself, right, to thinking it's your friend, but that won't ever make it actually true, right? So if you want to live in a space in which rocks are your friends, you have a reasonable entitlement to create that space for yourself. But in absolute terms, like, you will not actually gain what is the actual effects and consequences of friendship if you claim your friends are rocks, because that's just, there's the input's not there. And so, you know, putting a sticker on a day and saying, oh, this is an easy day and a recovery day, doesn't mean that it becomes easy or it becomes recovery. And this is something I've had to sort through in my own reflection over time, is basically acknowledging to myself that most of the time over the past 20 years, when I've thought that I've been taking it easy, and really, man, I guess closer to 25 years, honestly, but when I've thought I've been taking it easy or recovering or whatever, that hasn't been what's happening at all. I've just been out there grinding through whatever the fatigue level currently is. And then, you know, the next training day comes back around. I may misremember, but I have zero recollection of doing a single run at Bates and having any conversation from the coach or among the teammates about, okay, let's take it easier, let's go slow, or this is recovery. People just sort of went out and tended to run to the level of whomever the fastest, fittest person in the group wanted to run, and they were already probably running a little bit too quickly for their own good, because of these concepts of urgency and the concept of, well, if every day I can be doing something, I'm going to get better more effectively. And, you know, the reality is what ended up happening is most people didn't get in better shape. And to the extent that fitness did improve, they were just a total mess. They were just totally all over the place. So we should address first, what is the biggest counter argument to this idea of dispensing with this hard day, easy day, and saying every day should feel easy, and if it doesn't feel easy, you need to clock out and go home? I think elite athletes are what people would almost certainly try to point to. And we should explore that argument, because it's there, and if what we're saying has the value in terms of application, then we should be able to engage that argument and move past it. So I think there are three basic issues that go against the elite athlete's claim. So the elite athlete argument goes basically as follows. Well, these are the best performers. They are training in this way. They're getting the best results. Their higher level of performance is a result of their superior genetics, their superior capacity, they are superior human beings to the rest of us. And we just need to kind of accept that and move on. Okay. Therefore, once we've accepted that, we're left with, okay, how do they train, right? Will they have days that are hard? and are easy. And look at this, they really dunk themselves. And then these other days, they're really good at going easy. So this leads right into the first issue, which is vernacularization of training. People speak in a language that might not reflect their practical experience. So if you're given language, right, to speak in these terms, it doesn't mean that's actually what you're doing, right? So people can say, oh, I'm going really hard and I really emptied the tank. But if the social expectation is that you describe your training as I went really hard and emptied the tank, there is an inherent peer pressure to speak in those terms, because if you don't indicate that, then you will be rejected. You will not be accepted in that culture space, in that community space. Additionally, with the need to sort of like profile and expose and represent the preparation process, which I think brings a lot of value to these sports as shared experiences, as, you know, things worth following as entertainment sports, but also brings with it this need to, okay, I need to speak in the language of the genre, right? What is the language of the genre, and apply that in their particular script? Well, saying you went really hard, saying you emptied the tank, saying you really train hard, recover harder. Like, I mean, these scripts are, you know, noir-esque in their level of cliche riddled presentation and representation, but people are still in the thick of the genre. We haven't moved past the genre. It's not stale yet. So for a lot of us, we don't see it as these as dragging out these dried leather cliches. For people, it's still fresh and worth their time. So that's my first counter to this claim that elite athletes are doing X, Y, or Z. The second thing is elite athletes simply don't train harder. Okay, this is just point of fact. If they were to work at the same fraction of their total work capacity or total ability that most of us do, they would be exhausted. And it's worth noting that a lot of people who will achieve elite level performances oftentimes don't maintain continuity of performance, right? Where those may be a singular moment, right? One of a couple moments in a 5, 10, 15, 20 year career. And the rest of the time, they're very, 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 very good, but they aren't matching that level. But if you can run a 205 marathon, you should be able to run one every 12 to 20 months. I mean, that's a level that's real. That's not performance is not a fluke, right? It can't happen unless it can happen. So then why can't people just consistently create that? Well, we've accepted that as somehow being inherently difficult, but I don't. I don't think that's how that works. You know, if you cannot figure out how to go well in training too, then like when you need to then know how to manage feeling good for a race, like how are you going to do that, right? I mean, there's no difference. Being able to feel good is being able to feel good, right? And if you can't manage towards your training schedule to feel good and competent on every time you need to, then how are you going to be somehow likely to successfully quote-unquote peak on the day? And we've talked in the past about how things like tapering and peaking are not inherently real things, but are sort of more so a projection of the sort of disconnected, discontiguous way in which people are training. I'd also point to research by people like Steven Seiler, who pretty clearly developed a robust body of evidence that the best performing elite endurance athletes across all sports are going very, very easy the vast majority of the time. The thing is that they have the capacity to still perform their sport and go easy because they can run 8 minute to 10 minute pace, and that's genuinely a non-effort. most of us, if we go out and we run 8 minute pace, even if you run a 75 minute half marathon, right, you know, that's not truly easy to go out and run 8 minute pace. Even if you run a 70 minute half marathon, I would argue that might not be, quote, genuinely easy. Cycling, right? Most of us, if you go and average 16, 18 miles an hour, you might think, oh, that's embarrassingly slow for some of you by your standard, but that's probably still not easy. You'd have to be willing to go out and ride 10 miles an hour. And people just aren't willing to accept that. But there's some anecdote out there, you know, George Hincapie saying that, you know, they would basically do most of their rides at 18 miles an hour. And I think what happens is people look at that and they're like, oh, I can ride at 18 miles an hour. Okay, that's great. I just keep doing that and then I'll become really good. Well, no, that's a reflection of really their capacity, right? That they could ride 18 miles an hour and they're basically doing nothing in a sense, right? I mean, they're not. They're riding hours, right? Or the people are running and putting in all this time. But it's just the level of exertion is just null, basically. And it has to be, is what I would argue. And the people who really are the more consistent are the people who get closer to figuring out how to regulate how they feel on the day in question. And my third argument against the, well, elite athletes do blank, so that's, you know, case closed on how to train. Hard day, easy day is the way. And some of us just aren't being tough enough or we're not recovering well enough. The third thing is very simple. Like, it's not working for you. Right? It's not working for you. Especially if you're a regular listener of the podcast, I would go on a limb and I would say you probably have some level of dissatisfaction with what you've been presented with and what you've tried to apply, and you've had some sense of this can't be all I am with this sport. And because if you didn't have that thought process, I think other people reject Black Cats Run just out of hand, because it's so contrarian to what their view is and their thought process is. You know, the only significance though of training work rate velocity, right, however you want to think about that, watts, and training volume of work is if you can execute the training in such a way that you see improvement and it's not working for you. You probably have improved to some extent enough that it's captured your interest and you've continued to want to stay with the sport, but reality is it's probably not lining up for you in the way that you feel that it should. And this is what we were trying to develop as a conceptual framing in the previous episode, that training is something we do to gain leverage on improving what we call fitness, that the purpose isn't to simply do and tackle and execute the training, but the appeal of doing that can be overwhelming. It can be very rewarding as an end in and of itself to go out and, you know, do 10-mile runs frequently and do 50-mile rides. And I've, you know, enjoyed that aspect of it, you know, being able to spend that time outside, getting the satisfaction of doing that is rewarding. But ultimately, you know, you're just on a plateau and you're not getting any better and you're just sort of accepting that. It's not bad in and of itself, but when you realize how much better your whole experience could be if you could bump to that level of fitness up, right? What if you went from being able to do 210 watts for an hour to 360 watts? What if you went from being able to run 68 minutes for 15K to being able to run 56 minutes, right? I mean, everything is going to be different, more rewarding, right? Because you're just going to feel stronger and be more capable, and it just opens the doors to a better and improved experience. So I think these elite athlete arguments are just ultimately, and unfortunately, because it would be great if there was just this simple answer, but I think it's also good that there isn't, because if the answer was simple, then a lot of us would be left with the conclusion that, okay, I guess I just need to quit because it's not going to get any better, right? And if I'm not happy with where I'm at, That's just a so sad, too bad situation. So if, though, we're training correctly, right, if we're applying this idea of ease correctly, well, the application could be in programming terms, right? Of, well, do this session, do that session, and that could be sort of like a thought process about how to approach that, okay? But that is not necessarily effective, because then you get into this prescriptive issue of, is the training being prescribed in a way that is engendering what we want it to? So instead, we want to think about, okay, application is effective if it looks like certain things, right? That's how we measure that. Can we measure what's happening to in order to determine that the application is effective? Because you can't just say, well, I have application, so it's there, right? It's like writing a paragraph. You say, well, I have sentences, so I have a paragraph, therefore it's good, and there's nothing else about it that could change or be improved upon, and it must then also be effective as it is, right? But if you're going out and training, and you're telling yourself, okay, I'm going easier, then you can say, okay, the application is there. And that's doesn't work, okay? And I've, over the last 2 to 3 years, I think really 3 years now, I've basically been trying and working to try to make this transition. And I think I'm at a point now where I'm taking another step in this process of trying to change the way I engage with training around this. And it's not easy. But to what I've come to recognize, and I think what the source material supports as well, frankly, because this isn't just drawn off of my own personal experience, but trying instead to use my experience to relate to and better think about what we're trying to do, is we need to see a couple different things to confirm that the application is correct, that we are being effectively self-prescriptive, or if you are a coach in the position to have effective relationships with athletes and work with them across time, this is also what you would want to be looking for. So the first thing is, if we're training correctly, I would say 90 to 100%, I do think 100% is not just the goal, but I think it's achievable. But we should have a 90 to 100% success rate with workout execution, training session execution, such that it is easy, proficient, proximal, good practice when we're training, right? That we're doing it where we're executing, right? But we're strong, we're in control, right? We're not wondering if, you know, we can handle it. We're not questioning, okay, is this too hard, right? So, you know, in other words, we're not trashing ourselves, okay? And if we cannot basically go out there 9 times out of 10 and do the session and do it in that ease state, then that would be a sign that our application is wrong. That's the first thing you look for. And you can track that, right? If you had to be willing to be honest with your data when you self-evaluate, okay, I did the set, A, did I do the session? And then B, was it ease? Was it within that state, right? And you have to have confidence that you are doing enough to get your body to improve and become more fit without bringing yourself to point of failure. The second thing is, can we control race outcomes? Which in some ways is, to be fair, an extension of the first point. But I think people oftentimes are more willing to accept variance in outcomes with training and racing than they are, in racing than they are with training, I mean to say. And let me clarify. In training, people are more expectant of being able to do and perform what's on their schedule or within their plan. But with races, race outcomes, people are willing to just be like, well, you know, that's racing. You know, you win some, you lose some. Well, in a head-to-head sense, if you're sort of racing your peers of peer fitness, then like, yes, you do win some and lose some. But if you talk about like being consistent with your general level of performance, because the vast majority of us in this kind of stuff are really kind of time trialing, or like sort of trying to see, okay, what can I do? We're not really racing. I mean, gravel cycling is a good example of this, even, where it's like, ideally, you'd love to be able to be in the main group, but like most of the time, most of us are going to end up on our own. You know, say, okay, how well can I get around the course, right? Can I tag along with people to do that, right? But I think, you know, oftentimes you'll say, what can I do? And when you're looking at that, well, you should be able to be consistent with what you can do. And if you're just all over the place with your results, then you're not training at the right, your application is also wrong. The third thing is meaningful fitness improvements. So a lot of what we see with people improving is just going harder. And I think that this is one of the reasons behind the sort of marathon collapses that we see all the time, is people are not going out and running 25 to 40 mile runs on a regular basis. They're significantly under training relative to the race distance. Maybe not under training relative to what would be effective, but compared to the race distance, they're under training. It would be like if you only went out and did 100 meter to 400 meter runs just one time every day and you run the mile, right? Well, it'd be easy to get yourself to start going really well and over 100 meters to 400 meters, and then delude yourself into thinking, oh, okay, well, man, I look how fast I am. I can't wait to go to the mile and run whatever. And it's like, well, just because your run can go out and run a 460 doesn't mean you're going to go out and run the mile in 408. You know, that's not how that works. You're probably going to be, you know, running 5 minutes maybe, or slower, maybe 450 if you're lucky, right? So that would be a limiting factor for a lot of people. You know, that improvement curve, right, is then not actually like fitness improvement. It's just going faster and adapting to, and sort of your body adapting to this stress that you're putting on it. And then eventually, you know, people get injured or they regress because it's not actually a real training adaptation, right? Your heart rates get higher and such. But people like legitimize this stuff with nonsense like lactate tolerance. So meaningful improvement in fitness would look like greater work rate before you start to have lactate levels increasing beyond your baseline lactate level, right? Can you go at a higher pace than you could in the past without that lactate starting to accumulate? So people have rationalized out of that by saying, oh, wow, you know, look how good my lactate tolerance is. We've talked about before, lactate is not something you're tolerating or not tolerating. If your lactate is high, it's because you're dropping off at glycolysis to generate a lot of your ATP, because your body isn't able to carry through to the end of that carbohydrate oxidation process. So if we think about in terms of what the application should look like, right, that means we now have on the one side a concept, on the other side, now we also have some ideas of, okay, how might we think about or sort of confirm that our application might be working. The challenge then really becomes like, well, how do I on a day-to-day basis stay on the rails, right? How do I stay on the rail once I get established, right? So our goal for what training should look like are also going to be our dashboard by which we're going to be on a day-to-day basis looking to see, because if we're doing this correct, because the ways we've talked about confirming application, that takes a while. It's like when people are in a position where they're, you know, maybe have been inactive and they've gained weight and the doctor has advised them to, hey, you know, it'd be good to try to get a little bit back towards a healthy weight range, right? Let's make some changes to the diet and see if we can get back in a range that's going to be more healthy for your body. Well, you're not going to see those changes right away, right? And if you lose 15 pounds in a week, then there's probably something else going on. But the sustainable and, you know, meaningful weight loss might not really be evident until 6 to 8 weeks down the road. But, well, what happens in those 30, you know, 40, 50 days prior to the point in which you can actually reach a conclusion from the data? So we need to see criteria that are happening, right, in order to control the application. And then we need to have be close enough that we can target it to where we can get to the point where we can then see if those application valuation strategies can be applied. So that will maybe give us more specific feedback, but we need something at least, you know, approximating what we need to do on a day-to-day basis. So essentially, fatigue is what you need to focus on. If you're feeling tired when you're training from one session to the next, then you're doing it wrong. And that's the core concept that people need to be willing to accept. And that's the biggest departure and the biggest place where people are going to, you know, close out their Spotify application or Apple Podcasts, right? Because you have to leave something behind in order to make some progress here. So, you know, then we say, okay, I'm fatigued. So then we have to go to relative perceived exertion or some other concept of perceived exertion. And the perceived exertion should be basically non-exertion in a sense. And that's where it gets really frustrating for people because, like, how do you guide yourself towards a level of exertion that's a non-exertion? And that's where, you know, using the lactate testing strategy and trying to find what it feels like to be running as fast as you can before the lactate starts to accumulate, that's where that becomes, you know, so meaningful and helpful as a tool, as a way to try to recalibrate and identify that feeling, right? But you should be able to talk. You shouldn't be feeling uncomfortable. You shouldn't be having to, you should be, your mental focus should be around preventing yourself from going too quickly, right? It should be around controlling and managing your effort and pacing. That's where the energy should be going, okay? So if we've checked that off and the RPE is where it needs to be, then we need to then say, okay, this is a volume issue. And the correction would be, okay, we need to try reducing volume. However, if RPE is above ease, right, above that point of ease, right, if we feel like our breathing rate is higher or steady or noticeable, right, if we feel like we're starting to kind of like have to engage cognitively to maintain pacing and effort versus to prevent ourselves from overdeveloping pacing and effort, then we need to reduce work rate and bring that back down to the point where you're back at the point where, okay, like I'm thinking about keeping the brakes on, right? That you want to feel like you're charging the battery, feeling like you're making deposits, not withdrawals, okay? And if you're you have to keep being willing to adjust these two levers, the lever of how much, okay, the level of work rate, and then a part of that, you know, volume and work rate thing also includes if you're, you know, breaking your work into interval periods, being willing to be generous with the recovery. Because if a lot of people will be, and I've gone through this phase, I can't accept taking a 5-minute recovery between 4-minute intervals. That's not what I've learned. And, you know, okay, I'm going to do 30 seconds or 1 minute because, you know, that's what's necessary. But you do that and you're going to find that pretty quickly your training is going to break down and that you're not going to be able to be doing these sessions one day to the next. So once you're on the rail, okay, and you found that point and you're, you know, motoring along, right, you only ever look to increase volume, right? The perceived exertion, that always needs to stay dialed. And you just have to realize that if your fitness is really improving and you're focusing on that, finding that state of work rate, the velocities and the wattages, the powers will go up over time with that naturally because your fitness is improving. So a real improvement in fitness is, you know, basically being able to do a greater work rate than before without an increase in your level of exertion. Okay. So, you know, one of the ways too that we know that approaching it this way works is because it brings back the value of a coach, where having the chance to dialogue with somebody, having somebody who can, you know, be out there with you in person, take a look at what's going on, think about your body language, ask you the right questions, right? Try to give you some cues, right? Have that be a actual, like, you know, exchange towards this goal of recalibrating your thought process. That's also basically what we would expect to be necessary. So some sort of like communication process where it can't just be a, well, here's the splits, go hit these splits. You know, that's not really how it works. I mean, that's, again, pinning the tail on the donkey. Sure, you know, every once in a while you might prescribe the splits and you might get results, but that's like high school coaching at the high school level. And, you know, people who have one great performer every 4 to 5 years, oh, do they really understand, you know, how to coach the sport? If you really know how to coach the sport, 80 to 90% of your athletes should be performing at a high level. And that was true to my experience. And that was how I gauged if what we were doing was correct. And the goal was, you know, really to try to get that to be 100% of people, if possible. But, you know, there's some people just aren't really are there because they've been signed up for it, volunteered. Right, somebody volunteered them, not because they volunteered themselves. But the volume piece, right? If you're self-coaching, especially, what you want to understand is you're managing volume based on fatigue also, right? So RPE is managed based on fatigue, but volume is based on fatigue, right? So, but how do we know if we're fatigued if we're trying to train in a way where we don't feel fatigue? Well, the answer to this is when we start to, you know, lose fluency, that means we're going hard. When you no longer feel relaxed and bouncy and responsive, when you start to feel like you're having to sort of, again, apply your thinking process in order to generate the training process, that means you're going too hard. Now, of course, some people may say, well, but I want to run a marathon and you're telling me I can't increase my volume beyond these benchmarks, right? And beyond the level at which I would get fatigued. And if I do that, I'm only going to be running I can only do 45 minutes 5 days a week, maybe, right? When you first make that switch. Okay, well, how can I run a marathon? Well, if you just want to do one, then like whatever, right? You can do the sports however you want. But if you want to do something like a marathon at potential, well, then, you know, welcome, get on board with this, right? And accept that it might take a while to get to that point, which really, you know, 26 miles is a significantly longer distance than people are exercising on a regular basis on foot anyway. Some people ride bikes, 26 miles is a decent ride too, right? It's not an inconsiderable distance. So I think it makes sense that it would take a while to really build up to being able to do that with proficiency. You know, that's a high level of demand to be able to perform a skill at that level, where the level is executing that skill competently across a long time span. That's not easy to do. It takes practice. So, and to do there, we have to allow yourself to be slow. I mean, another frame of application is, am I slow? Do I feel like I'm training too slow? You know, the Klaus Lux easy interval method, he talks in his book about, you know, how he ran his best 10K, you know, running 250s, splits, 250.4 for what his 1,000 meter splits. But that in training, he would usually be running, you know, 315 to 325. So basically running approximately 30 seconds slower over what is approximately a little bit less than around a 3 minute interval, right? So that's a huge reduction in what he was trying to do. And, you know, it's not going to confirm for you that you're going to be able to do that. My youngest brother, who I sometimes use as a COD example on the podcast, but, you know, he is a half marathon best of 67 minutes. You know, and after doing that, he understandably went through a period where he's a little more amped up about running some road races. And, you know, tried to go after Beach to Beacon a couple years in a row. And I think he really wanted to break 31 minutes. And he sort of just got hampered up in the 31 to 32 to 32, 30 range. He couldn't quite get down where he wanted. And what he would start doing is then he started trying to go out and practice running 5 minute pace and doing it extensively. And then he's, you know, would go to the road races and the legs weren't there. Whereas when he ran 67 minutes, he wasn't doing any of that stuff because he didn't have this bee in his bonnet about anything in particular. He just went out there, started running, was running whatever those are, 508s to 510 mile splits, and he felt good and he kept going. And all of a sudden, you know, boom, 13.1 miles, all done, right? And it was after that fact. Then he couldn't allow himself to, quote unquote, be slow. And it's not easy, right? And that goes to my point that even people who are able to do this at an elite level struggle to sort of bridge that gap. An example for me recently is this week. You know, I had thought about trying to go down to do the USATF Grand Prix 10K road race, not because I thought I was going to do anything miraculous, but I had been feeling good and I was thinking, oh, might be something interesting to go and do. I haven't really done a road race in quite a while. You know, why not, right? When you go out there and you feel great, it's always a worthwhile experience. So I then decided, you know, okay, you know, I guess I'm not going to do that. You know, my person I was going to go do it with had a work commitment, and they're like, they didn't know if they'd have the energy. So I thought to myself, okay, maybe I'll just go out in my morning session. And I'm going to work out on my own anyway. And I said, well, I'll just warm up and I'll just do a 10K. You know, I'll just try to do a steady 10K and see what happens. So I warmed up and I couldn't find my headlamp. And so the first 10 minutes I couldn't really see, and I was trying not to break my ankle in the potholes, you know, and so that probably wasn't necessarily helping. But, you know, I got around through my, you know, 3 kilometers of striding and jogging, warming up routine. And I said, okay, right, I'm just going to start. I'm trying to feel relaxed. I'm not trying to prove anything to myself. And I went 1 kilometer and I was just like, this feels horrible. You know, it had been nice and cool for a while in the mornings. And now all of a sudden today it was 98% humidity and 65 degrees outside, which, you know, at 5:30 in the morning in September is a little bit more than you're then adjusted to. And so I just accepted the fact that I just didn't have it. And I said, I'm just going to stop. My chest hurts, and I'm getting that feeling, a burning sense I get in my chest if I'm, you know, working too hard. My, you know, breathing is out of whack. And, you know, I don't feel smooth. I feel sort of stiff and clunky and stale, and I feel uncomfortable, you know, running just the first kilometer. And you know, I ended up doing that, you know, in like 360 watts. It was like it was like a 7:30 pace or 7:23 pace, four minutes and whatever, but 4:37, I think maybe. You know, but like nothing, which usually is mindlessly easy, but wasn't happening there. So on the one hand, I could have said, okay, I'm disappointed and what's wrong with me and how come I can't run, you know, I feel uncomfortable and weak running 360 watts, but, you know, I only did a kilometer. Usually I start out with 1 kilometer reps and I'm going 400 watts or whatever, no problem. You know, instead of looking at it that way and falling into the trap of saying, well, you know, I suck and blah, 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 and this is the variance and I don't have these talents or these skills. I said, well, what have I done? So yesterday I was out with my friend and we were doing thousands, and they didn't want to be late for work. So after the first rep, I said, well, let's cut the recovery to 500 meters from 800 meters. That'll save 5 minutes. So, you know, I look at my watch and I see, okay, 500 meters. Okay, start the next rep. And as I'm doing the next rep, I realized, you know, in my crack of dawn brain functioning, that that would have only been 300 meters because the recovery counts down from 800, not 1,000. And I just saw 500 and I had it in my head, wasn't thinking about it, started. So then I was like, well, I feel really good. I don't feel like I need more recovery. I'm just going to keep rolling with this, you know. So, you know, ran them in plus or minus 415, which, you know, is on the stronger side of what I've been doing for these, but felt very relaxed, easiest I felt running those, right? And the idea isn't, could I do these, right? If I wanted, I could do this one workout of repeat thousands a week and I could crank them all in 340 to 345, right? They would be vicious, but I could do that. So this is significantly backed off, but, you know, I'm trying to back off to the point where it's like, okay, am I really gliding at a tempo, right? That's what I'm aspiring to do. Can I have it be as easy as possible? Because that's a sign of proficiency, you know, not going out and trying to sort of just wring the sponge absolutely dry. So I did that. And then today I tried to do this time trial run that I had jazzed myself up about and I couldn't, right? So even though that day before felt like nothing, the reality is cutting that recovery to 300 meters was too much. It felt easy, but, you know, if you're one, another rule of thumb is if you start to sort of feel like you're getting excited and amped, that's probably a sign you're starting to work too much. And for me, you know, cutting the recoveries down to 300, right? Cutting the recovery duration, you know, by more than 50%, by like, you know, down to like 210 from like 5.5 to 6 minutes or whatever the heck it was, significant, more than a 50% reduction in recovery time from the routine, you know, and then cruising these reps and feeling, you know, getting amped and, you know, that's a sign that it's too hard. You shouldn't be getting an adrenaline response or an amplitudinal shift like that to when you're doing training. And that's also the thing, is that also has the masking effect too. Whereas you start to get that exercise arousal response, you stop processing that fatigue in the same way. So we're left with the situation, though, and the conundrum of like, well, if we can't use this traditional system of training to failure, exhaustion, or training to an inability to maintain pace if we try to attempt another rep, that we can't determine how we're doing enough, right? And that's where, like, it the application is difficult, and you have to understand what are you trying to do, and you need to orient yourself before you do it. And then you have to be able to think about it as you're going, and you have to reflect on it. And it might be helpful for a lot of people to, you know, have a notebook or have open up the notes app on your phone or open up a document in Word and write down, like, okay, this is how, not write down your splits per se, but write down, okay, this is how it felt. You know, did it feel easy across the workout? If you felt like you were working harder across the workout, that's not good training. And that's sort of what I've been really, I would say, still struggling with the most for my part over the last 8 weeks now of trying to make this next shift in changing how I'm approaching this stuff for my part is keeping the workouts controlled and not leaning into the tempo and just accepting being easy. And, you know, it's been pretty rocky, and it's getting better, but it's not a linear transition, and it's not a sudden transition. So part of it is you have to be willing to be patient with yourself and realize you're going to mess it up because you're learning a new skill, right? Like learning any new skill, you're initially going to be piss poor at it, right? But if you continue to orient around what you're trying to get to being able to do, you'll make that progress, and that progress eventually you'll start to feel like you're breaking through a little bit and feel like you start to make a little bit more progress a little bit more quickly. So, you know, the first standard, referring back to assessing the application, right, focused on what is our success rate with our training sessions, that we want that to be 90 to 100%. The second was, can we control our race outcomes? Can we feel good and can we feel competent on our races? And the third is meaningful fitness improvements, okay? Those are our benchmarks that we're working with. But I want to introduce one other concept, and I want to bridge something from economics, actually, into the podcast. As an educator, economics is one of the subjects I teach, and I think there's a lot of interesting ways in which you can take those concepts and you can apply them to training, because training is also a decision-making process that's essentially driven by resources and trade-offs. So when we train, right, we can do more, right? And we know in this approach, we're setting ourselves up for that to absolutely be true, because we're saying that we're not going to failure, to exhaustion, or to an inability to maintain pace. That's not what we're doing. We're using fatigue in a different sense to be, okay, like, do you need to break training, right? If you have to break training, if you can't string together the sessions because you start to get too tired, or if you start forcing sessions because you're having to push through the fatigue, then you're not training well, right? So we're using fatigue in a different way. And in economics, there's a concept called marginal analysis. And marginal analysis looks at the revenue per unit produced and the cost per unit produced. So if you produce one scoop of ice cream, that might cost $1, and the sale price for a scoop of ice cream is $2. If you produce a second scoop of ice cream, maybe the cost of production is $1.50. On the third scoop, maybe it's $4. Well, at that point, right, you wouldn't want to produce three scoops of ice cream because your costs are now greater than your returns. And another, this is also the concept of diminishing returns. And people in exercise culture oftentimes think that, well, the, you know, milking the cow for all it's worth is the best thing we can do. But that really becomes like squeezing water from a stone. So if we think about this marginal cost and marginal return and net value, not as in terms of like money, but if we think it in terms of like fitness and strain, like what's really going on? And you might make a connection here to these like fitness management graphs like Strava and Training Peaks have, and some other platforms. And I think those are kind of junk. And I would sort of throw those out and disregard those. Those can really get in your head, actually, and mess with you. You know, unless you really have laser-like confidence. So I would stay away from looking at those if at all possible. But so I'm talking about this in terms of like what is methodologically true in application, not how it actually would be measured, right? But let's say that you're doing repetitions of 1 kilometer or 4 to 5 minute repetitions or something like that. So let's say the first repetition, the fatigue cost is, we call that FC, fatigue cost is 1, okay? And let's say the TR, the training return, is 4 for each rep, right? Each rep is worth 4. Every time you do 1,000, it's 4. And let's say the second rep, the fatigue cost is also 1, okay? Revenue is 4. Fine. So after first rep, our net workout return is +3, right? So we had 4 benefit, right? We had 1 cost, leaves us out of 3. Second rep, so that's 1 cost, 4 revenue, right? 4 return, training return. Okay, now we're at +6, okay? Now we get into the third rep, right? Now we're starting to maybe get a little bit activated, a little bit more engaged, starting to just feel like we're using the energy a little bit more. Let's say the cost of this rep is 3, okay? Well, the return is 4, right? The value of 1,000 meters is still, we're going to say, is the same, all right? Some people might disagree, but I'd point out that their argument is that the value of the repetition is increasing because of the fatigue. And I think we've pretty extensively in other episodes and laid out that that's probably not how training adaptation works. So you can go back to those episodes. We've got that argument mapped out, I think, pretty effectively. So then we go to our fourth rep. And let's say now the fourth rep, and this is common, people will eventually find that rep if they do it in the old school traditional way where, okay, now the cost is through the roof. So let's say the fatigue cost of this rep is 7. So after the first rep, let's review, our net return is 3. After the second rep, our net return is 6. On the third rep, our fatigue cost jumps to 3, but we get a profit of 4 in terms of training profit, right? Training return, we get a profit of 4. So that's now our net is at 7. So there's a bigger jump in benefit from the first rep to the second rep, much smaller from the second to the third, but still there, so you can still justify doing that. Now, on that fourth rep, because the fatigue cost is so high, the marginal revenue model, right, marginal analysis, okay, sale price is the same, right, and applying this to training, the training return, the training benefit is the same as 4. So now our net is back down to 3. So in this hypothetical scenario, when we apply this concept of marginal analysis, what we see is that after fatigue and the demand of the workout gets past a certain point, we are literally taking away from our training. And this is where people really, I think, are going to struggle the most conceptually here. And I think it's the most essential conceptual gap to bridge. Say that 5 times fast. The most essential conceptual gap. Okay. Because people will say, well, if the value of each rep is 4 and you do 4 reps, 4 times 4 is 16, so the total value of 4 reps is 16, so you want to do 16. And so that's the best. And who cares about the fatigue? I've got the improvement of 16, and I will just recover the fatigue away. I'll recover it into non-existence. However, what we actually see in practice, and I think this is pretty well demonstrated on a level of just common sense of just open your eyeballs to the world around you, is that past the point of marginal return, people actually aren't improving as much, which is consistent with what a marginal analysis model would show, that by doing that additional rep, you're not banking that right for later. If you think of training as just building a brick wall, right? So the first rep, you add 3 bricks. After the third rep, you now have 6 bricks in the wall. Sorry, at the second rep, you have 6 bricks in the wall. After the third rep, you have 7 bricks in the wall. But now on the last rep, you now have 3 bricks in the wall again. That's not progress. That's regression. You'd be better off just doing the 1 rep because you'd have the same progress, but you wouldn't have wasted that time and energy to get literally nowhere. And what that means is that there's a point in training where what you're doing, and this, again, this is a paradigm shifting concept for people, so you got to have an open mind about this and really try to reason through what is your basis of resistance to this understanding instead of just dismissing it out of hand. You get to the point where your training is actually reducing your fitness. Okay? It's reducing your fitness. And that actually jives with everything we see with injury and with overtraining and all this other stuff that's out there. So I think it's actually very much in keeping with what we know to be true. And now some people would say, okay, well, now you're just saying you got to do low volume. And that's just confirmation bias that training debates are basically high volume versus low volume. This marginal analysis doesn't support low volume, okay, although it appears to, right? Because you say, well, if one rep is just as good as four reps, that's low volume. Low volume training is not better on that basis. That's not how that works, okay? What the marginal analysis does is it supports the idea that you do as much volume as you can. That's literally the argument it's making, is that as much volume as works is what is effective, right? So training is effective and worth doing if it is effective, not based on how much or how little it is. Like, you aren't missing out on speed by not cutting back to 4 hours a week of training or 3 hours a week of training, nor are you missing out on the supposedly amazing transformation into a monster endurance runner by not executing 150 miles a week. Because if you can't run 150 miles a week, there is no benefit for you to miss out on. You can't miss out on that because there's nothing there for you. The fact that it may or may not have worked for somebody else, that just shows their marginal return supports that. Their marginal return to marginal cost relationship supports that for them. And that's what marginal analysis shows, is that when we train at a point of fatigue, it's not neutral. It's not, okay, well, I'm not improving anymore right now, but, you know, later it will come back. Okay. You're taking away. You are literally making yourself worse. And if you really think about it, what happens? You do that work. Well, then, like, what happens is for a while, everything you do stinks compared to what you were doing. Now you can't do anything nearly as well. And what is that if not getting worse? And people say, well, eventually you feel better. Okay, if you're willing to back off and recover, you'll do better. But where do you end up? You basically usually end up more or less where you maybe started, or you make a small improvement. But, you know, if anything, is that within or without a standard deviation, right? Probably not, right? It's probably just within that natural flux range. And you start feeling a little more recuperated, and then you start having better sessions, but you're probably just back where you started. And you find you just can't do additional training from that point that is effective or where you want it to be. You can't have the application of your concept in place because you have damaged it, right? And so instead of seeing progression, you're now regressing. Oh, I could run mile repeats in 5:50, but now I'm struggling to do them in 6:20, and then rationalizing that into like, well, that doesn't mean anything. That means, well, yes, it does. It means you are now struggling to run 6:20 pace. Like today, right? I could have, and once upon a time would have, just made myself do 9 more kilometers, maybe would have felt a little bit better, but the reality is would have been struggling and been uncomfortable the whole time. Not useful, okay? But being exhausted also simply isn't where good things happen. It's not an adaptive state. So feeling good, feeling fresh, and most critically, recognizing that fatigue is the sign your application is not working. thanks for listening to today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed what we've brought forward today. If you like this, you can check out any of our other episodes, and you can also check out our Instagram page at Black Cats Run. If you have any questions or you want to reach out, let us know if you're enjoying the podcast. You can message us there, or you can send us an email, blackcatsrunpod@gmail.com, and we'll catch you next time.